Thanks for that great reading. We are bearing down on the end of the Easter season, as Sam said. Pentecost next week marks the official end of Easter season. So thank you, Sam, for choosing two Easter hymns today. 1 Corinthians 15 is often called the resurrection chapter. It's an inspiring, encouraging, and hopeful case for resurrection. And it's always been a little hard to get hold of. Just speaking for myself, 1 Corinthians 15 is challenging for at least two reasons. The first has to do with the historical context of the church in Corinth, and the second has to do with our context. So first, Corinth. We don't really know the precise questions that were causing conflict in the church at Corinth, to which the Apostle Paul so forcefully responded in this chapter on resurrection. We do know that those questions were dividing the church, and we do know that Paul was passionate in his response, and we know that Paul felt that the very ground of their faith in Jesus was at stake. We can guess, but we don't know with precision the actual argument in the church around resurrection. So that alone makes this chapter a little challenging. But then add our context into the mix. We live in an age and culture shaped deeply by a scientific and rational worldview where our default posture toward resurrection tends to make it a kind of metaphor for life, or at least to spiritualize it. So our approach to resurrection doesn't mesh very well with Paul's very pointed words in 1 Corinthians 15. If we today would walk around town saying out loud to random people the things that Paul says in this chapter, people would likely turn away, avoid eye contact, and assume some kind of mental disturbance was going on. Especially some of the parts that were skipped over in the middle of the chapter, where Paul points to baptism on behalf of the dead as evidence for resurrection, or to his fighting wild animals in Ephesus as more evidence, or Paul's philosophy that there is one kind of flesh for humans and another kind of flesh for animals, another for birds, and another for fish. It's all just a little incomprehensible. Even Paul's last joyful and triumphant refrain stretches our rationality. When the last trumpet sounds, our perishable bodies in the grave will clothe themselves with the imperishable and be raised. It's all just a little hard to talk about in a way that makes sense, unless we speak of resurrection as a spiritual reality or some high-level metaphor for life. But Paul isn't saying that. It won't surprise you that scholars don't agree entirely on how to read this chapter. But it is safe to say that resurrection was a very real argument in Paul's day, an argument that followers of Jesus were deeply invested in from very early on. Why? Most people, Apostle Paul included, believed that Christ's return to earth, the end of the age, would occur in their lifetime. So resurrection was something that needed sorting out. It was a justice issue, a fairness issue. It wouldn't be fair when Jesus returned very soon if it was only those still alive that got to be part of the heavenly kingdom, that got to rule with Christ on David's throne. While unfortunately those who had died in the 20 plus years since Jesus was around, who maybe even died as a martyr, would just miss out on this new kingdom. That wouldn't be right. So early on, among Jesus' followers, a core message of their preaching was that we shared with Jesus not only Jesus' humanity, that we also shared and partook of his resurrection. We shared in Jesus' heavenly nature, in his immortality. For early disciples, belief in resurrection led directly to a firmer trust in God's goodness, in God's just and righteous nature, and a stronger commitment to follow Jesus no matter the cost. Because if they believed their own resurrection was coming, they would be more willing to risk their lives. When the heat was on, they would be more likely to stay faithful to Jesus. Now, it seems to me in our context, with our scientific and evidence-based worldview, and with our relative wealth and comfort and safety and freedom and choice, resurrection doesn't have quite the same gravity for us. Compared to the first followers of Jesus, we don't have as much skin in the game. And I think the same is true if we compare ourselves to our 16th century Anabaptist ancestors. So where am I going with all this? How should we read this chapter today so that it actually makes a difference in how we live our lives? It made a real difference for Paul's readers, who were expecting in their own lifetime for Jesus to come back and set up the new kingdom in Jerusalem. Without a theology of resurrection, the world wasn't fair. And Jesus' promise of a new kingdom was a hollow promise, and their faith was in vain. But with a robust theology of resurrection, they had reason to keep the faith, to stay engaged. So what is the practical difference for us today, who realize that the kingdom of heaven has a very long timeline, who live in a scientific and rational world, and who have a secure and comfortable life in the here and now? Is there a theology of resurrection that still matters on a daily basis? Do we still need resurrection? Do we still have skin in the game, so to speak? I believe we do. And for me, it's not a physical argument. I really don't feel like I have a lot invested in being right about the mechanics and nature of physical resurrection, or about what an imperishable body looks like compared to a perishable one. For myself, guided by my understanding of what this text actually meant to Paul's first century readers, it comes down to this: resurrection is a theology of hope. To believe in resurrection is to assert that God's purposes are sure and that God is not yet finished with us and the world. If 1 Corinthians 15 helped followers of Jesus stay hopeful enough to keep the faith, to stay engaged in the struggle, to work to make their world a better place, then there's no reason to think it shouldn't do exactly the same for us. A theology of hope, a theology that trusts God's purposes, a theology that God isn't finished with us or the world, is exactly the theology I need to live courageously in a world like the one we live in. For me to stay engaged, I need to know that God's work is not yet finished. I need to know that there is goodness in the universe beyond my own small existence. I need to have hope. In the face of a world full of death, I need to know that death isn't the last word. Or as Paul put it, in a fascinating turn of phrase, death has been swallowed. Swallowed. Now, Paul could have used a more straightforward phrase, like death has been defeated or destroyed or done away with. But here he says, death has been swallowed by life. In Paul's world, followers of Jesus just kept on dying. Paul and his fellow travelers lived with a daily threat of death. And all Easter people still deal with the harsh reality of death and other life-draining evil all around them. I think Paul wanted to tell everyone, us included, that resurrection life does not do away with death, it swallows it. Life overwhelms death. Life eats death. It swallows it, consumes it, digests it, lets it be transformed into something new. It puts death in its place. You might say in this resurrection chapter, 1 Corinthians 15, the God of life is defining the narrative. Defining the meta-narrative. Death and the grave have no power to control the narrative. They have neither the last word nor the first word. We are invited into a narrative of life and into a community that lives by that narrative. Resurrection may not be rational or empirical, but it is an overarching narrative that redefines the universe. So this morning, I say to our graduating seniors, and I say to us all, we have real choices about how we turn and face into a world where death seems so powerful and dominant and predominant and is in our awareness constantly. We need not despair. We need not run from death or run from suffering. In hope, we can proclaim the truth of God's victory over the grave. We can proclaim with Paul that death has been swallowed by life, and then live like we believe it. May God help you, Hannah, Sophie, Silas, and Eleanor, and may God help us all.